Dean Walter Brigerman of Eden is familiar to most of the members of the consortium. He has agreed to discuss with us some new perspectives in biblical hermeneutics, and we will give him 40 minutes, and we will have 20 minutes to discuss the topic, after which we will do our departmental business. Okay, Walter?
Understand this debate today to be a kind of an in-house matter, and so that it's not a paper that I would defend very far. I have studied the Gattung for this kind of presentation, and one important element is to tell you that I really haven't had time to prepare, and I suppose that will become evident to you as we work along, but there are some ideas that I have been struggling with, and I am eager to get your reaction about it. I have said shifting hermeneutical categories, but I am not sure what the word hermeneutics means, so that may not be what I'm talking about. Beverly Childs has described the excitement and the power and also the apparent failure of a hermeneutic which came to be expressed as the mighty deeds of God in history. In this country, George Ernest Wright has been the key figure in formulating that interpretation, though he was very early aware of von Rahn's work. It is important that in his early essays in this direction, already in the 40s, Wright was especially concerned to challenge the Wellhausen developmental scheme of the religion of Israel. Here he would obviously follow the lead of Albright in his From Stone Age to Christianity. It is important that the hermeneutical categories of Old Testament scholarship in this country, and perhaps also in Germany, if Forer's attack on von Rahn is to be taken seriously, but at least in this country, was intended as a refutation of the Wellhausen developmental hypothesis. It is exceedingly important and not often noted that it was the Albright-Wellhausen conflict that caused the history of Israel's religion to be set along the lines of a conflict between Canaanite religion and Israel's faith. So very early, George Ernest Wright wrote the Old Testament against its environment, and as you know, that was matched by Filson's The New Testament Against Its Environment. The emphasis against any history of religions approach was clearly to be upon the distinctiveness of the Old Testament. I have been pondering how decisive it has been that the word against was selected and has been used to shape our understandings. It is a word that has created a posture for us and a mindset which has created a remarkable tilt in our work. I cannot comment extensively on the German scene, but surely von Rahn is a child of Barth's attack upon Schleiermacher, and so the same againstness appears there, though perhaps not so sharp nor so simplistic. Nevertheless, the extent to which that same issue arose in Germany means that in both areas, a 20th century challenge to 19th century cultural Christianity, both broadly with Schleiermacher and more technically with Wellhausen, has given us the controlling word against for our understanding of the Bible in relationship to its context and to its cultural thought forms and symbols. It has become increasingly clear to subsequent scholars that againstness does not say it all, even though we use that word. Professor Hobble can speak for himself, but my impression of his book, Yahweh versus Baal, is that the title does not completely represent the complex interaction between biblical faith and Canaanite culture and linguistic forms and symbols which he means to illuminate. It is methodologically problematic, I believe, to proceed as Albright has done, to be concerned only with distinctiveness and yet to make the case primarily by a study of the way in which Canaanite forms illuminate the biblical text. We are currently, I believe, itching to move away from that kind of simplistic againstness. I mention only in passing Albrecht's remarkable statement about a God who acts in history as a common ancient Near Eastern motif. But I regard Walter Harrelson's work as more insightful, even though less technical. Already in 1964, Harrelson dared to suggest that syncretism is not all bad and in any case cannot be avoided. He urged that syncretism be understood as an imaginative use of resources for dealing with new problems and issues. He said in an Andover Newton Quarterly, "Dangerous though the process may be, it is the way in which Israel's faith came to be that enormously rich and complex reality we find it to be." And then he concludes, "Thus I encourage you to reject those counsels that call us to hold the church away from other religions, to keep the religious practices of the church pure. It cannot be done in any event. In words that are familiar to you, let us then sin bravely, but with discernment." End quote. More recently, his study From Fertility Cults to Worship has appeared. It is an innocent-appearing little book which seems to call into question the simplistic againstness of our exegetical practice. I believe that is a book that is much more important than it has been credited to be. Neither Albright nor Wellhausen appears in the index, and Harrelson surely has no wish to return to simple developmentalism. However, my judgment, which I believe is also Harrelson's judgment, is that those issues are over with and we have more important and pressing hermeneutical issues. And when we no longer need to react to the developmental hypothesis, we may indeed be open to fresh insights. He states this rather boldly, quote, "The Israelites certainly gave large place in their thinking and in their worship to the motif of fertility. They were no less in need of means to ensure that the crops would provide food for the coming year than were other peoples. The Israelite religion was also a religion of fertility. It had to be, or it would have been of no consequence for the people. If Yahweh did not provide the grain and oil and fruit, the people could not live. The rivalry between Baal and Yahweh is amply testified to in our Old Testament literature. It will not suffice to say that the Israelites worshiped the God of history while the Canaanites worshiped the God of fertility. Yahweh was both the God of history and the God of fertility," end quote. Of course, Harrelson is not the only one who knows that, but I believe it is our clearest challenge to the againstness of our hermeneutic. Harrelson has urged that our hermeneutical task is now pressed to fresh engagement with culture, which challenges any simplistic over-againstness and requires a new formulation which allows for fluidity and diversity and rich interaction. Perhaps a non-committal, the Old Testament vis-a-vis its environment, is a better statement of how it is. Now, in that context, I want to pursue one motif, namely the time-space issue. We are all of us, of course, aware of the judgment popularized by Bowman that space is Greek and time is Hebrew. I do not want to handle that according to Barr's well-known polemic, but rather to make the case that our hermeneutical againstness has led us to a very one-sided statement. That is, it was not only our careless linguistic methodology, as Barr argues, but our commitment to againstness as a hermeneutical stance which has created this overstatement. I was stunned to find from my own teacher, James Meilenberg, this statement: "Of the two great peoples who have exerted an influence upon the mind and soul of Western man, Hellas and Israel, the one lived and thought primarily in the world of space, the other in the world of time. To this spatial mentality of ancient Greek, the mentality of Israel posed a perfect contrast. The comparison of the biblical references to sun, moon, and stars with those of the other and Near Eastern texts disclosed the radical difference between Israel and the surrounding people. In Israel, the mystery and meaning of time is not resolved by an appeal to the cosmic world of space." End quote. Now, obviously, there are some correct statements here, but it is also correct that Meilenberg's statement is code language for much more that has been most clearly expressed by Wright's books, The Challenge of Israel's Faith, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, and God Who Acts. As we are aware, the time-space model served to stress theology expressed in categories of eventfulness, election, covenant, all of which took its beginning point from God's intrusion into history. This theology found meaning in the discontinuities of history, in the intrusions of God, and the unspoken counterpart of such a perspective is clearly that the continuities, the cultural continuities, are not arenas of meaning, and that the structure of creation awaits the intrusions of God. The structures as such are not bearers of meaning. In his more recent statement, The Old Testament in Theology, Chapter 3, Wright seeks to reformulate the issue in less drastic fashion, but he is still bothered by the dangers of evolutionary thought. Now, for the sake of the tape, I want to assure you that those categories are all very important to me, too. But it comes clear to me that they are products of againstness as a deep hermeneutical commitment that may not be fully adequate either to our contemporary task nor to the text. So I want to ask, first, does this account for the evidence? And secondly, what logical spin-offs may be credited to our new task? First, I've had to ask if the simple time-space model articulated by Meilenberg and Bowman and many others, but surely believed among all of us, accounts for the data. I propose as an alternative understanding that Israel is a people intensely interested in space, for which we may read creation or land, and that our clinging to time categories precludes our understanding of Israel as it really was. And secondly, I suggest that if Lord is the office of God in terms of which time and events may be understood, then Father is the office of God in relationship to space. And the Lord-Father imagery is dialectical and cannot be simply resolved as Wright has done. I take it a movement in such a direction is indicated in Wright's recent book, in which there is a chapter on God the Creator, along with the predictable ones on God as Lord and God as Warrior. And I shall not argue, but suggest that the polarity can be expressed by speaking both of sky gods and earth gods, that is, the tension of rigorous, uncompromising ethic on the one hand, and on the other hand, an assured continuity. A tension over againstness has resolved too easily. And I suggest, for example, that Richard Rubinstein has been driven to death of God theology precisely because one pole of this polarity has been eliminated in recent discussions, and he had to go outside of biblical faith to find the other pole. Now, obviously, it is important to select the right texts to make any point. And obviously, the Mosaic materials have been primary for the hypothesis of over-againstness, though it is instructive that in his 1964 article, Harrelson speaks of syncretism with special reference to the prophets. I want to focus primarily on the 7th, 6th century text to suggest this other pole, and as you know, Norman Gottwall has suggested that the exile is a period in which Israel's creative theology and literary effort was extensive. Here I suggest rather obviously that the 7th, 6th century theology of Israel is deeply concerned with the questions of space, that is, our relationship to the land, precisely because of exile. I will not pursue all of that. I want to mention Machol's article on Ezekiel, in which he argues that Ezekiel talks in terms of the new land division. I want to mention my recent article in Zetov A on the priestly tradition, in which I have argued that P is concerned primarily with land. I want to mention, with reference to the Deuteronomic tradition, the article in Interpretation of P.D. Miller, Jr. on the theology of land. And then I want to mention a not much noted article by Wilhelm Fischer on Deuteronomy 11, that text that says that the land is not like the land of Egypt, that you don't have to water it with your feet, whatever that means, but the rains come. I take it that that is the kind of affirmation about the theology of land that our hermeneutical categories largely have tended to neglect. But mostly I want to comment more extensively on the Jeremiah texts, for it is clear that Jeremiah is the poet of the land par excellence, and I think that is most curious because Muhlenberg spent his entire life studying Jeremiah, and yet he writes as he did that Israel was a time people. After I had this thing in process, I ran across the book by Diepholz. I don't know whether you've seen it, Israel's Land. And it's on, he studies four traditions, Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomic history, Jeremiah, and the Deuteronomic parts of Jeremiah, and it's kind of exciting. I don't think he carries it in the direction that I am concerned to argue here. So I'm wanting to make the case that a careful study of Jeremiah would indicate that the disregard of the space theme, as we have split it in terms of time-space, really indicates that we have betrayed the text very radically. And these are some of the texts that I simply want to call your attention to. Jeremiah 2, 4 to 13, it is clear that the history of Israel is a history of the land. Verse 6, he refers to the land of Egypt, the land of deserts and pits, the land of drought and darkness, the land where none passes through, the land of plenty. It's amazingly how repeatedly he uses the word Eretz. And then he concludes by saying, you have defiled my land. And the conclusion is, I think by implication, now you will become landless. And I think Jeremiah means to ask the question about what kind of faith is it if it is a landless people, and I think he means to say faith is ended and history is over. in that text. Now, he obviously says some other things in some other places. In Jeremiah 3, 1 to 5, you know the text that derives from the business about marriage. In Deuteronomy 24, he says, "You have polluted the land with many lovers." And then he repeats it, "You have polluted the land in your harlotry." And then I think most important in Jeremiah 3:19, as Yahweh say, "I thought how I would set you among my sons and give you a pleasant land, a heritage bounteous of all nations. I thought you would call me my father and you would not turn from following me." And then a parallel to that in 3 verse 4, "Have you not just now called to me, my father, thou art the friend of my youth?" I think it important, and I will return to it in a minute, that the notion of the gift of the land and the loss of the land in 3:4 and 3:19 both relate to calling God Father. And as you know, in 3:14 and 3:22, Israel is called sons, disobedient or backsliding or turning sons. A peculiarly powerful piece of poetry in 22:29, in the midst of a lament for Jehoiakim, verse 28 grieves the exiled king, and verse 30 draws a conclusion about the dynasty. But between those two verses, there is this remarkable two-line statement, "O land, 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 hear the word of Yahweh." Now, Diepold says that quite clearly land here means Israel, but I don't see that seems to me very problematic without first facing what the text itself expresses. The phrase "hear the word of Yahweh" sounds like our usual emphasis, but I think that an address to the land suggests that the primary concern of Yahweh is the land, a category that we have generally excluded on principle. The expression suggests, in this one isolated place, that in the crunch of the Babylonians, Yahweh's concern is not Israel, but is the land. And then I want to comment on the remarkable statement of Jeremiah 29:11, which I judge to be the center of the Jeremiah tradition in any case. "I know the plans I have for you, plans for shalom and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations." And then this conclusion, "and I will bring you back to the place from which I exiled you." Quite clearly, this is a promise of restored land. And Diepold comments, "Thus, for Jeremiah, Israel's future belongs with the land." The other thing I want to say about that text, I have been wondering if the language of a future and a hope is the utilization of an older sapiential word pair, since Jeremiah is the only place where wisdom hasn't become the way to interpret it all, why it ought to be looked for therefore too. But in Proverbs 23:18, "Let not your heart envy sinners, but continue in the fear of Yahweh all the day. Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off." And in Proverbs 24:13 following, "My son, eat honey, for it is good, and the drippings of the honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is such to your soul. If you find it, there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off." I think it important that future and hope are the concerns of a sapiential tradition which is not interested in the intrusive deeds of God. The older wisdom sayings speak of well-being for the future without any over-againstness in right sense. It is simply the plan. It comes because life is built that way, and I find it suggestive that Jeremiah uses that language for Israel's future, especially with the verb hashav, plan. And finally, three texts from the Book of Consolation. In the purchase of the beleaguered land in chapter 32, the climax, as you know, is in verse 15. "Houses and fields and vineyards will again be bought in this land." Now, that is a remarkable statement for seeing the future as land, but I think it's also important because of the passive form in which it is stated. Here an assurance is not stated like a mighty deed. It may be argued that the mighty deed is implicit, but I think it is important that another rhetorical expression is employed. And then I wish simply to note that in Jeremiah 31, verses 35 and 36, and then in a separate unit in verse 37, appeal is made to the permanence, the structural permanence of sun, moon, stars, heavens, foundation of earth, to argue about the assurances Israel can have of her future. Land is not mentioned, but the argument is expressed in references to ordered space and not to intruding event. Now, this is a very undisciplined, scattered kind of evidence, but that will tell you the kinds of things I've been wondering about. Now, I wish to talk about the second word pair, and that is Lord and Father. In a series of articles, Wright has contended that Israel refused to think of God as Father because it smacked of Canaanite syncretism and suggested physical derivation of people or person from God, and that, of course, cannot be countenanced. I suggest that we re-examine the conclusion, which was at least in part derived from the general over-againstness of our categories. In the Journal of Near Eastern Studies in 1942, Wright argued that the ruler-vassal image is the dominant language and that the father-son imagery is late. That's one argument. Or that it is an intrusion. Or that it means ruler. Surely one of those will explain all the texts. I will not repeat all of the texts. He again alludes to that argument in an article in Biblical Archaeologist, 1943, and then he summarizes it again in his challenge, The Challenge of Israel's Faith. Now, nobody should be held accountable for arguments of 30 years ago, and in fairness to Wright, two important developments have come since then. First, Wright drew these conclusions before much of the study about royal theology and the king as the son of God, in which it is clearly admissible to use this language for the king without suggesting physical derivation. Secondly, the enormous work on treaty and covenant since has permitted us to understand many words and images differently and in political categories, which alters the issues considerably. McCarthy in 1965, in an article in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, argues that the father-son business is treaty language and insists that it has no dimension of tenderness in it. But there is a danger in understanding the word in the context of royal or treaty or wisdom language, as Wolff argues, in settling a question in a way which robs the image of God as Father of its power. Such an approach can be a leveling process which concludes that Father means King and the problem disappears. I think that is a tendency that McCarthy courts. I want to suggest that the Father-Son imagery, speaking of either God and King or God and Israel, does indeed carry special freight, but not freight that can be dismissed as non-Israelite. I suggest that the Yahweh Israel or Yahweh King imagery, when expressed as Father-Son, refers especially to a theology of land. That is, Yahweh is Father precisely in those contexts because he is the bestower of land, the one who causes Israel to inherit, and the king or Israel is precisely the son because he is heir to the land and he receives it and takes responsibility for it. The statement of Exodus 4:22, the first one cited by Wright, itself contains no land statement, but it seems clear to me that 3 verses 7 and 8 belongs to the same cluster of old traditions, and it assumes that to free Israel means to go to the land, for land is clearly the meaning of the firstborn in Exodus 4:22. One text, early text where that's put together is in the old legislation in Deuteronomy 21 about the firstborn son and his share of the Nachalah. In the programmatic dynastic statement of 2 Samuel 7:14, the actual verbiage contains house and throne, but the preceding statement of 10 and 11 speak of place and rest. To be king, and you recall in 2 Samuel 7, it says, "You shall be my son." To be king above all means to receive the land of the deity, to have it entrusted to one as his kingdom. And in Hosea 11:1, again the son imagery, it moves in verses 5 following to speak of loss of land as loss of sonship. Now, the text cited by Wright, including the ones I have reported here, I think it is important that those texts cluster, especially in Deuteronomy, Hosea, and Jeremiah, the three traditions which are, I think, most concerned about the problems of syncretism and purity. And those three textual traditions are most intensely concerned about the care of the land or the loss of it. Now, of course, the entire hermeneutic of againstness has had a difficult time with Hosea's use of Canaanite imagery, as Harrelson has noted. And surely if God as Father were in any way problematic, we should expect especially that these three traditions would avoid it. I submit that they utilize it because it is imagery most appropriate to speak of Yahweh in relationship to inheriting the land. Half the texts cited by Wright are in these three traditions, not counting 4 and 2nd and 3rd Isaiah, which may well be derivative. Thus, the image becomes prominent precisely when the land becomes a primary question in the faith of Israel. The most compelling evidence for this connection of land and Father are in the two texts I have already cited. In Jeremiah 3, verses 3 and 4, "Therefore the showers have been withheld and the spring rain has not come, yet you have a harlot's brow, you refuse to be ashamed. Have you not just now called to me, my Father, thou art the friend of my youth?" And the other one in Jeremiah 3:19, "I thought how I would set you among my sons and give you a pleasant land, a heritage most beauteous of all nations, and I thought you would call me my Father and would not turn from following me." The first of these speaks of polluted land and harlotry, and the latter speaks of my Father and Nachalah. The poem presumes that to qualify for Nachalah, I think, one must say Abi. The counter theme of faithlessness and therefore landlessness is stated in 3:14 and 22. In Jeremiah 4, verses 20 to 22, it includes this statement, "The land is laid waste because they are stupid sons." And in 31:9, "I will lead them back, I will make them walk by brooks of water. Surely I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn decree." Thus, the father is engaged in land giving. And in 31:16 following, "They shall come back from the land of their enemy. There is a hope for their future, and your children shall come back to their own country, Gabul." And then this couplet, "Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he my darling child?" Israel in the 7th century found it difficult to acknowledge Yahweh, a commonly recognized problem. But Wright observes that in 2:27, Israel credited the wrong father, who say to the tree, "You are my father," and to a stone, "You gave me birth." However, Wright suggests that the verse means to indict Israel for using the notion of father. However, the stone tree also occur in Deuteronomy 4:28 to suggest Israel must not acknowledge stones and trees, but Yahweh. That is, against Wright, it seems to me, the indictment is not for calling God Father or using the language of fatherhood, but assigning the role to the wrong agent. Patrick Miller has suggested that law and land belong together in Deuteronomy and all those traditions, and I have no zeal about minimizing the importance of the Torah. But I think it important that in the period when the loss of land is a key issue, as it was in the 7th and 6th centuries, then Israel must say Avi, not Adon, I think, for only by claiming the Father is the inheritance received from him. And I find it suggestive, I don't really control the data, so maybe some of you New Testament exegetes want to respond, that in two of the three places where the New Testament preserves the Aramaic Abba, Father, in Romans 8, 15, and Galatians 4, 6, Paul writes of inheritance. I believe a clear tying together of the two themes of land and the Father. The Father who gives space to his people is surely the Lord who commands, but he shows himself differently to his people. He shows himself in his radical graciousness as the one who does not intend displacement for his people and will not finally allow it. Now, that's a, I'm aware that's a tenuous hypothesis, but let me suggest what that problem has come to mean in my own theology. I have suggested that there are three polarities that might claim our attention: time, space, Lord, Father, and the sky god of intrusion and the earth god of structure. And I suggest that our simplistic againstness has served certain hermeneutical interests well. It serves well the kind of Barthian theology expressed in the Barman Declaration, which had to speak to the question of sovereignty. And I assume that it would serve well the kind of theology that Herzog was arguing for. In a very different way, Herzog would not argue for, it served well the kind of quest for meaning which came to be expressed in a lot of pop theology and which came to best expression in Tillich's formulation of the gospel as a courage to be in the face of meaninglessness. That is, the mighty deeds of God in history came to be interpreted as existential decisions which gave meaning in an otherwise meaningless existence that we had to endure. The whole emphasis upon decisions, I believe, is correlated to that. What this argument means for me is that the issues have clearly shifted. I don't know whether you have read Sam Keane's little book, To a Dancing God, and it is an undisciplined popular theology. I'm aware of all of that. But I have learned a great deal from it. Keane contrasts in that book family stories or people stories that have continuity and happenings, on the other hand, which live and which thrive on discontinuity. You know about the kind of happenings that are that people have. Keane's judgment, which I share, is that to substitute happenings for stories, which I think happens, do you have the impression that the building is being dismantled?
It's just the mission.
Keane's judgment is that to substitute happenings for stories, which I think is related to the collapse of our family institutions and all this kind of thing, cannot be sustained and will lead to insanity or collapse of the structures of society. Now, what I want to suggest is that the story-happening pair be related to the space-time pair, which is so common among us, and to suggest that a hermeneutic which requires us to speak only of eventful intrusions and times of meaning, which are God's happenings, and precludes structures and continuities in terms of holy space and holy security, is both one-sided and unhealthy and not viable very long. So long as happenings were happenings credited to God, so long as they are regarded as holy events, they seem important, but nonetheless they are happenings. And they are described as isolated events which intrude into an otherwise meaningless world. And I submit that Keane's critique applies not only to the pop existentialism, but to our best hermeneutic, which has focused exclusively on the mighty deeds. I think something like that is what Beverage Childs is talking about. I submit that the cultural crisis we address is not that of the 40s and 50s when Wright formulated his polemic. I believe that the question has shifted from one of meaninglessness, in which events make a lot of sense, to rootlessness, when we must talk about space and structure. And I think there are whole lots of statements about that. Simone Weil's The Need for Roots, Toffler's Future Shock, all of John Updike's writings, I think, Couples, Run Rabbit, Rabbit Redux, Of the Farm, John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, Mice and Men. The yearning of that literature is not for a meaningful intrusion, but for a sustaining structure, or if I may put it so, not for a time, but for a place. Not a redemptive act, but an enduring blessing, to use Westermann's distinction. I believe that our hermeneutic of againstness taken by itself, makes contact with the issue of rootlessness very problematic. Israel's moment of rootlessness is exile. On the one hand, there is an affirmation of time. Second Isaiah, it is time to go. But more consistently, there is a gospel of place, that you will be in your land again. Now, I am aware of the dangers of such a theology of the earth, for it surely can lead to the perversions such as expressed in Hitler's earth religion. And I have the impression the same perversions are contained in Rubinstein's own handling of the world as jungle. But I believe that biblical exegetes can better bring the text to our work with Marxists and with Jews and with the disenfranchised of all kinds. I had blacks written here, but I this morning have had to think about the disenfranchised women, so I say all kinds. The ecology crisis, if we restore a balance which our hermeneutic has tended to deny. Moreover, I believe that it will illuminate our liturgy if we can see that along with the representation of the mighty deeds, there is entry into the structures of our place through myth. I believe that in the 7th and 6th centuries, Israel was discovering that it is an enormous gift to say Abba. It is to receive an inheritance and to answer for it. And of course, we must say Lord and honor the Torah, but to say Father is to receive an inheritance prepared for us from the foundation of the world. Finally, I want to say that while I am not competent to even talk about Gogarten's work, I think it is not accidental that from his study of Galatians 4, he has formulated it this way, that it is responsibility before the Father for the world, and to be a son means both. He writes, in the concept of the heir and his responsibility for the inheritance, it thus becomes clear that perseverance in sonship and that which occurs in it not only occurs between the Father and the Son, but also between the heir and his inheritance. And I think people in exile worked at expressing it that way. Well, that means... time if you want to respond.
Thank you very much, Lord. We have 20 minutes to discuss these new theses back and forth. You and I both would share that sentiment from the German national anthem of 40 years ago, Lieb Vaterland,
yeah.
Max Ruhig sein, which puts Vater and Land right together. Okay, where do you want to start? With the against, or with the time space, or with the Father alone? If you please. Warm?
Yeah, I'm going to have to run soon, so I'll get my paper thing. First, about Father, I would think that there is more than one tradition that goes into the understanding of the nature of the Father picture that's in the Old Testament. I would think that Deuteronomy 32 would have to be seen not on the same level as an inheritance whereby the Father gives the land as inheritance. There, at least you've got the tradition that the land is Yahweh's own nachalah, his own inheritance.
And that's true also, as you know, in the Jeremiah text, he moves in and out of the text.
So you have a kind of level in which the Father God gives to the council, if we will, or in any case, Yahweh gets that as his nachalah. And in those texts, you get the picture truly of God, in some sense, as really giving birth the rock, which is clearly a space image to describe even the Father himself. Mm-hmm. He gives birth to, like the cosmic mountain or the earth or something, gives birth to his own son. And I think there you would have to reckon with something other than strictly the land as the inheritance, some kind of progenitor language fully is preserved from, I would say, a Canaanite background. And that's a different kind of syncretism. It doesn't deny the space element, but it's a different kind of space element that would be brought into the picture. That's the one thing. The other thing, I would wonder whether or not The kind of language, the kind of studies being done that have been done in the past by the Scandinavian school have very strongly preserved spatial dimensions in terms of the central Jerusalem cult, among other cults, where the central sanctuary, understanding in terms of mythical space, is indeed the replica of the universe, or the central, sacred, earnest guarantee of the total land or world or universe, so that what happens at this place, this space, is a microcosm of the macrocosm. So the spatial dimensions have been strongly preserved in that kind of field, and look like Ostrom's aspects of visualized syncretism strongly indicates that that was never ever lost, at least in the cult, the Jerusalem cult, if perhaps it was minimized in other areas.
And the problem in terms of the history of scholarship is that those are the texts that the mighty acts of God people have tended to neglect. You know, so what I've been wondering about is whether those same kind of emphases can be located in the very texts that we've used to build the mighty acts of God in history or approach.
And the other question I would have is whether or not, in connection with a lot of the creation theology in the Old Testament, the whole motif of von Rath, that creation theology is inevitably subservient to Heilsgeschichte, and redemption theology must be totally re-examined, and that ultimately all of life is lived in a creation context, and that you start with that as a given and you end with that. From the womb I came and I returned to the womb. That kind of context is the life context within which one begins and does theology. And even the structure of scripture is kind of the creation framework. And that therefore the intrusion is only intrusion into a particular space, even if it's not time intrusion.
Now, I'd be interested in your reaction. Have you had a chance to look at von Rath's wisdom book?
It's on my desk.
To me that von Rath really has moved away in his later stuff, in which he talks about creation theology without reference to Heilsgeschichte or Credo or anything like that. And I have had the wonderment, I don't know whether anyone will ever know, whether von Rath, you know, saw this before anybody else and moved away from it. Because it seems to me he really, in that book, wants to argue that creation theology is a parallel or a competitor or something and does not subordinate it or derive it from the other. It seems to me remarkable that he can do that. I think his central and most exciting chapter, it seems to me, is entitled something like The Call of Creation. It moves very much in that direction.
Okay.
Yeah, may I ask Norm a question? You have any reaction to what I said methodologically about, I alluded to your book, but I'm not laying that on your book particularly.
I've been working with creation theology quite a bit of late, and so I tend to have not even felt that problem any longer. I guess I've passed beyond the fight, and I've been trying to find out the ways in which the symbols of space and the symbols of time intersect, and whether there are other comparable symbols. In the language of sky god, for example, as the symbol of that which intrudes is only one of the symbols of the sky god, because there are also symbols of the sky god which are structuring symbols as well as intrusion symbols.
Right.
And I think that you better be careful about making those too simplistic.
Yeah. Right. I don't really want to use that kind of language. That's language that Richard Rubenstein uses, and I think he lumps a lot of things together, and I guess I follow him doing it. But that isn't the ground on which I want to make the case.
When you establish your three polarities, or this is a certain againstness right in that series of three, isn't there? Each time, the land and the space-time.
Yeah, except that what I want to argue is that they're both there, and our way of doing that recently has been to pretend that the one drove the other one out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any New Testament comments on Galatians 4, Gogarten, etc.? Yeah?
Bob?
I don't know what kind of comment this is, but some of the stuff that you're talking about is, I guess part of what you're saying is that if you pick up one end of any pole, you're going to run yourself into difficulty sooner or later, and somebody's going to come along and tell you that there's another end to that stick. I'm reminded of the way in which people talk about the church, for example. Some of your words have been used, some of your polarities have been used as people think about the nature of the church. Identity versus universality. Particularity versus catholicity. And I wonder why it is that there are moments in history, say in the history of scholarship, when people will emphasize, as they did in the 19th century with Kulturprotestantismus, emphasized the universality. And then along comes the First World War. Was that what did it? The collapse of that culture, the discontinuity, is it the optimism of the 19th century evolutionists, which collapsed with the barbarity of the First World War, so that the theology of the word thrown like a rock into the world from God becomes believable. But it becomes believable until we finish the Second World War.
Yeah.
So that Reich, you quote articles that Reich was doing in 1942, 43. All that stuff is still believable. But then a new generation arises which has not known First World War, Great Depression, Second World War, which is, thinks, life isn't all that bad. I wonder, you did not seem to say anything about optimism, pessimism as psychological mindsets which move a person towards choosing one end of that pole or the other. And I just didn't want
to... Well, I think that's certainly a factor. I hadn't thought about it, but I'm sure it's a factor. I think that's implicit in the statement. I really found it mind-boggling that what Wright and Albright were really doing was attacking 19th century concepts. But they mostly didn't say it that way. They mostly did it by putting it on the Canaanites. It was remarkable. But and I think that's related to what you're saying. Yeah. I've been corresponding with Vestman more about that distinction he makes between salvation and blessing. And I think this is the same kind of thing that I think Wright's approach in that whole business only knows how to talk about salvation. And I thought that's what Herzog had to talk about. But salvation is a very tricky notion in an affluent culture. And I suspect that is that the drive Westermann tried to create that polarity. That salvation is something that the disinherited yearn for, and blessings are something that the well-off celebrate. And I think that Mighty Deeds theology can't admit to blessings, because that's creation theology. So that's another angle.
It's optimistic, it's healthy,
that's right.
It's affirming.
Yeah.
They read the apocalypse in the concentration camps.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it was relevant literature.
That's right.
When you're working in the 7th and 6th centuries in Hosea, Jeremiah, and the Deuteronomic history, would you say that the 8th century doesn't have the Father, Son nearly so implicit in its message? Father-Son relationship?
I suppose partly depends on when you date Deuteronomy.
Mm-hmm.
But if we locate the present form of Deuteronomy in the 7th century, that seems to be very much in the Deuteronomic stuff. But the relationship between Deuteronomy and Hosea may be tricky too. So, I don't know. But of the texts that Wright lists and seeks to dismiss, of the datable texts, the only one before Hosea is Exodus 4.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be some earlier ones in the Psalms,
Additional questions, comments? Yeah, Bob?
I just, Fred, you were in?
No.
No? Sometimes I wonder how much of it is related to the time-space thing. I guess I had questions in some of the passages that you were quoting about land. The temporal dimension was still present in that the gift of the land was a future promise, or a promise to be fulfilled in the future. And didn't quite know how to get a hold of that. So that wasn't spatial versus, well, you weren't saying it was spatial versus time, you're saying you want to overcome that dichotomy anyhow.
Yeah, I think that the problem with those texts is that they are stated in a way that you can choose to emphasize what you want to choose to emphasize. And to make the point today, I've got to talk about the space stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it's important that people like Wright have used the very same text to make the argument for time. Yeah, I agree with you that what we got to do is talk about how that all got held together some way. But today I simply want to make the point that the other is there. Which may suggest for some of this stuff, the whole question of time and space is a really irrelevant question. But I don't think it can be irrelevant for our exegesis as long as we are, as I perceive us being, still deeply committed to that way of interpreting Scripture. In the United Church of Christ, not a doctrinal church, as you know, but our United Church statement of faith, which comes as close to a normative theological statement as we've got, which Roger Shinn wrote, it is a recital of the mighty deeds of God in history. I think it's kind of typical of systematic theologians. They don't stay with what's going on, and therefore you get that kind of statement. Now, I think this makes it very problematic in the seminary, for example, to try to teach on the edge of, you know all about that problem, or keep it out of it, try to teach on the edge of where our disciplines are, but you really got that other formation there that our students have to take seriously, and they really fight each other.
Yeah, Fred?
I'm wondering if you would comment on the possible relationship between the space-time polarities and so forth that you were mentioning in the current attempts to better understand apocalyptic and its beginnings by the polarity of myth and reality. I don't know if that's really that.
Well, I don't know, but I haven't studied apocalyptic that much, but Hansen's recent articles, he has three that I know of, JBL Interpretation and Review of the Bleach, out of a Harvard dissertation following Frank Cross in arguing that apocalyptic is a reassertion of the old primeval myths. I haven't thought of that in connection with what I've been arguing, but that might be very important, which Hansen says, and you certainly got that in Eastern Europe, that's why the Book of Revelation is that you get apocalyptic when the crunches of history become unbearable and you must posit meaning somewhere else. But that seems to me to be a withdrawal from history into some kind of cosmic space. The determined times and all that are there, but that's not the same as mighty acts of God. Though I'm very interested in Bonhoeffer's challenge about deriving apocalyptic from the prophets and what if it comes from wisdom. Surely more space oriented. Did I hear you at all?
Yeah,
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking
of
Hansen.
Yeah.
Further questions?
Well, it's time for your business meeting, but may I say that even we don't have a chance to say that to you, exegetes of Concordia. But we're kind of aware of what's happening, and we don't know any way to stand with you that wouldn't be more trouble to you. But we would like to find ways of standing with you if there were ways to do that that would be useful to you.
We're glad that you came today, even though some say that means they're standing against us.
Yeah, I read about that
person. Well, thank you very much, Walter. You're welcome to stay for our other session. But I think we'll conclude this section.
Yeah.
Let's give Walter another hand.
Thank you.
Thank you.